Hi, folks. Happy Wednesday, and welcome to Food for Thought. On this week's episode, we're speaking with Alex Urich, the founder of NewSkew. What's unique about NewSkew is they're a Canadian-based modern food company built for rapid recipe development and brand prototyping. For context, rapid is not an adjective typically used next to the term product development, normally a very time-consuming, capital-intensive process. As a result, NewSkew owns and operates a portfolio of food brands aimed to create quality food products that match modern food culture. The NewSkew team is comprised of former food advisors to consumer food brands with deep insight on fast-tracking the product development process that traditional CPG struggles with. The result is a unique conglomeration of craft brands that adapt to changes in modern food culture and quickly become scalable into more mainstream channels. You may be familiar with their brands without knowing it. Let's dive in and learn more. Alex, where does Food for Thought find you today?
Oh man, I wish I were in my backyard right now, but there's a lot of leaf blowers in the background. So you're finding me in the living room of my house in downtown Toronto right now.
Right on. So tell us about NewSkew and what you guys are all about.
Yeah, so NewSkew is a company that myself and my partner Scott started actually almost exactly 3 years ago. And this was after years of working with all of the big Fortune 500 CPG companies and a lot of the big grocery retailers, and just seeing how innovation at a product level in food is slow and challenging and kind of just fraught to be expensive for big CPG companies. And for grocery retailers, they are looking to compete increasingly on assortment and looking to attract new consumers. And just by seeing that play out over and over again, I think after a couple too many drinks and a couple too many dinners, my partner Scott and I said, you know what, there's an opportunity for a company like NewSkew to be able to not just create products and brands, but also bring them to retailers, bring them online, bring them into alternative forms of distribution, and get them to market in ways that big CPG companies wouldn't be able to, and much faster than we'd be able to. And that was really the premise of us starting was, can we be that organization that brings food and beverage products to the market, essentially with the speed of a chef, but with the scale of someone that thinks like CPG?
So can you break down your portfolio of CPG micro brands under NewSkew? By my count, there's five. There's Detour Coffee Roasters, Royal Canadian Mead, Rainbow, Route Root, and Deer Grain. Is that correct?
That is correct. And the way that we think about it inside of NewSkew is, we think about it as platforms. So coffee for us is a platform unto itself. It's our largest line of business. And Detour is a coffee roasting business that we actually acquired, about 3 years ago. It's been in the specialty coffee market for the better part of a decade. It has broad distribution across Canada. And in terms of coffee, it's one of the best coffee roasters. I think I'm a little bit biased, but I think it's the best coffee roaster in the country. And for us, coffee is a fantastic platform to innovate off of, because we're able to have so many wonderful conversations with essentially cafes and people serving consumers every single day. So for coffee for us is not only a method of kind of growing in a high demand consumer category, but it's also a way for us to learn pretty heavily what's going on in the market. Royal Canadian Mead is part of our alcohol platform. And this is a brand that we actually launched a little over 14 months ago. And what Royal Canadian Mead is it's basically bringing the world's oldest alcohol to market in a much, much more modern way. And we'll get into a little bit about what that is later, but we're essentially creating a gluten-free, low-sugar, all-natural drink that's actually using honey as the fermentable sugar rather than beer or apple juice or grape juice or anything like that. And then the final platform of our business is the CPG platform of our business. And inside of that, you'll see Brainbow, which is keto chocolate truffles that are powered by adaptogens. We've got Root Root, which is a plant-based jerky that is actually made entirely from peas. And last but not least is Your Grain, which is our sourdough everything platform. And that's sourdough chips, crackers, cereals, pastas. So if you imagine anything grain reimagined into a much more natural sourdough format, that's what Dear Grain is really working to commercialize right now.
So there's a lot to unpack there, Alex. Maybe let's start with adaptogens. What are they and what function do they play?
Absolutely. So if you look at Nu Skew as a whole, what you'll find is a bit of a common thread is that Nu Skew is really good at taking ancient concepts and modernizing them in ways that aren't really necessarily expected by consumers. And I think adaptogens are a really good example of that because they've actually been around for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And if you've ever been into a natural health food store, you've probably seen a big wall of different ingredients that you wouldn't necessarily understand. And a lot of the cases in those natural food stores is what they are is they're adaptogens up on those shelves. And at their core, adaptogens are herbs and mushrooms that provide some type of functional benefit. And what we're doing with Brainbow is we're actually taking these herbs and extracts and mushrooms and we're adding them into our keto chocolate truffles, which are honestly incredibly tasty. And they provide a lot of the same functional benefits as you would from a much more traditionally medicinal format. And so what we've done is we've created a blend of these adaptogens specifically formulated to, we're calling it mental superfood. But if you think about being able to provide a lot of the same focus, wakefulness, and creative energy without necessarily the crash of caffeine, that's what we've really been focused on in the development of this product.
And to clarify, those are functional mushrooms. So are you using lion's mane, chaga, reishi, something along those lines?
You nailed it. Those are actually three of the biggest components of the recipe there. There's actually six others that are included in the formula, but lion's mane, chaga, cordyceps, and reishi are among the largest ingredients.
So out of curiosity, Alex, I'm not sure if you can share, how do you create a chocolate product and make it keto?
Totally. That's a good question. So what we're actually doing is rather than starting with chocolate, our recipe actually relies on us starting with a cocoa bean. And if you think about how you go from a cocoa bean to chocolate, it's really being able to separate out the solids, the butter, as well as the sugars in it, which is really what is chocolate at its core. And for us, what we're doing is we're leaning very heavily into, when I say that our truffles are indulgent, what that means is that, we're leaning heavily into the cocoa butter side of things. And we're leaning heavily into the cacao side of the flavors, but we're really, really kind of leaning out of the traditional sugars that are added to chocolate in the manufacturing process. So if you look at our ingredient labels, there's actually no traditional sugars in it. We're using a little bit of coconut sugar, but that's really all of the sweetening that's happening in our product.
Very cool. Let's switch gears to mead. So admittedly, I haven't tried mead, but it's the oldest alcoholic beverage in history. So what exactly is it? And, you know, kind of in what format is it comparable to? Is it like a beer, a wine, a liqueur?
Well, I think it's interesting because what mead is at its core is alcohol that uses honey as a fermentable sugar. So when we think about wine, what that is this grape juice that gets fermented into alcohol. When we think of beer, it's barley or wheat or any other type of grain that gets fermented into alcohol. And when we think of mead, what that is it's honey that gets fermented into alcohol. Now, it's an amazing, or one of the amazing benefits to that, but also to be honest, one of the challenges with mead is that it can be fermented similar to wine, where you have a lot more honey added and a lot more fermentable sugar. So you can get a product that's kind of 13, 14, even 15%. That drinks like a wine, often cases is heavily sweetened like a dessert wine almost. And that's what a lot of people think about when they think about mead and Vikings and all of that sort of stuff. On the opposite end of the spectrum is actually what we're manufacturing as Royal Canadian Mead. And we actually call it session mead because it's designed to be much more sessionable, like a light, easy drinking beer. And what we're doing is we're taking a similar amount of fermentable sugars as you would find in a cider or a beer. And we've created a product that is actually, our products vary between 4% and 6%. And really the only ingredients are honey, water, yeast, and whatever other type of flavorings that we want to add, whether it's peach or hops or anything like that. And we end up with a product that is entirely natural. We're fermenting out almost all of the residual sugars, so we actually have less sugar than a typical beer or even any type of cider. And it's naturally gluten-free just based on how we're manufacturing it and the ingredients in it. So you end up with something that I like to think of is pretty crushable on a hot day, but also has a lot of versatility where you can add different spices or add it to different cocktails to get something that's a bit more appropriate for winter.
Very cool. I'm definitely going to have to try it. So switching gears a little bit, what enables New SKU to fast track the product development process? And when you guys were starting New SKU, can you articulate to the viewers sort of a typical timeline for, you know, a large CPG company of from ideation to commercialization? Whereas what New SKU is doing, you know, you pride yourselves on saying you're designed to keep pace with food culture. And obviously food culture is rapidly innovating, especially in a time like COVID-19 when people's preferences and how the modalities in which they consume and find their food is changing. Can you share a little insight on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And when I think about designed to keep pace with food culture, the line that goes with it in our heads at least is that we aspire to innovate like chefs. And what that means is every single day, what a chef is faced with is they don't know what ingredients are going to be fresh. They don't know what ingredients are going to come on the back of their truck. You can't forecast when strawberries are going to be ripe or I mean, I've tried this and I failed this is to know when an avocado is ready to be eaten. And that requires creativity, that requires innovation. And that's why typically what you see is you see food trends existing in restaurants and hospitality and those sorts of settings much, much, much more than you would see existing on a grocery shelf for a host of different reasons. And so when I say that we inspire to innovate like a chef, it's really bringing in speed into innovation and being able to see those sorts of things that are happening in restaurants or at farmers markets or in really interesting food channels that haven't yet appeared on grocery store shelves, because that's really where we first start to see what's happening in consumer culture and their relationship with food. I think from working with not a small number of large CPG companies, by the time that they see a trend happening, it tends to already be on a grocery store shelf. It tends to have already existed out there by a new entrant that's starting to get traction in the market. And in order for a CPG company to respond, there's so many things that they need to do in order to commercialize a product. And when you think about moving at scale for those companies, it's retooling production lines. It's developing new brands. It's developing new products. It's developing new ways of thinking inside of those organizations about what their brands and what their products mean and stand for. And at the end of the day, that's a process that from ideation or even identifying a trend to commercializing a product, it's 3 years, it's 5 years. I've seen things take 10 years to make it to market. And at that point, there's no trend that you're catching up with. There's probably a next trend that you've already missed at that point. And that's really the market need that New SKU is trying to respond to is how can we be that company that takes that inspiration in much, much, much faster and is able to actually turn that into products and turn that into brands and turn that into sellable propositions that we can put on shelves of grocery stores all across North America.
That's a really interesting insight. What is the model exactly for New SKU? So obviously you've built out a portfolio of micro brands and trying to scale those rapidly. There's also, you know, friends of yours and friends of the podcast, like A Recipe for Tomorrow, that does consulting for these CPG companies. Do you guys engage much with these companies, or you are trying to bring those products to market yourselves because you have that agility and that market insight built up from, you know, numerous previous ventures and having, you know, good foresight into the industry?
Well, I think it's one of those things where every single member of our management team and really of the broader New SKU team, it starts with being incredibly passionate about food. There's not a single member of our team that does not get excited about eating, cooking, consuming, anything about it. And I think that's really where it all starts is in our organizational DNA, like being passionate about that is and new product development especially is first and foremost. So I think that's kind of where it begins. I think how we actually do it is I think relative to a big CPG company, the makeup of our management team is quite a bit different. As a part of our innovation process, we have people that are exclusively responsible for looking and identifying and understanding new trends that are existing in the market. We have people in our team who we've got a much, much greater focus on the brand development side of marketing, the creative development in branding and being able to actually take an idea and proto brand it and put it in front of people and test it, is a huge part of what we do and a capability that, I think is invaluable in helping us move forward. And I think the last piece of the puzzle is having a product development team that is heavily, heavily, heavily integrated with what we're doing on the sales side and what retailers and what consumers are actually looking for is kind of key in us being able to move things to market much faster. By the time that we start to commercialize a product, we know that there's a customer, i.e. a grocery retailer, and we know that there's a consumer there for us so that we've got a high degree of certainty that we can get something on the shelf, but also that a consumer is going to take it off the shelf.
Mm-hmm. You'd mentioned taking a chef approach to CPG. With COVID-19, it's obviously wreaked havoc on the food service and restaurant industry.
Absolutely.
Do you see some of this culinary talent migrating to the CPG space and taking that chef approach and trying to turn that into shelf-stable products that you'd find at a grocery store? What are you seeing amongst, you know, chefs that you know, or just from what you're hearing in the industry?
I mean, this is really where innovating like a chef comes in. Is there's been really wonderful examples of innovation and product development throughout COVID that I don't think previously would have been able to happen, and I think we're just getting to the beginning of it. What I've started to see is actually one of my favorite restaurants in Toronto, Donna's, developing packaged food offerings for different bars that I like going to, which is, it's honestly increased the quality of food that I've had out on patios throughout the summer, which has been a really wonderful thing. And I think that's one example that's kind of showing that, restaurants no longer need to innovate inside of their four walls or build business inside of their four walls, which is really, truly a fantastic thing. And I think that's kind of, I think product development in a way that is retail ready or ready to scale up is a completely different game. But I think the signals are there that we're starting to see restaurants with amazing brands start to develop products that can appear on shelves. So it's starting to happen. I don't think, at least in the Canadian market, there's too much there yet, but I really think that we're on the eve of that starting to happen, which is really wonderful. There was actually a New York Times article earlier today, about Pret-a-Manger in the UK, really leaning out of their retail locations and into the products that they've developed themselves. And so I think the writing's on the wall everywhere of where chefs can kind of find success in this new and uncertain environment is for sure.
Mm-hmm. I'll have to look up that article. So New SKU is a Canadian company based in Toronto. How, sort of a two-part question, but how do you view innovation that's happening in food and beverage in Canada relative to the US? And you have physical and brand assets in Canada, but you've also entered the US market. What are some of the lessons you've learned about, you know, how you go about garnering market traction in a geographic location? Do you look at it as very specific markets? Do you look at it as a national strategy? How does your team, you know, view product distribution?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think on the differences between the two markets, or how innovation exists differently in the two markets, I think one of the biggest differences between Canada and the US is in the US, branded product innovation is a very established industry. If we look at everything from toys to technology to food, consumer brands and the value of developing consumer goods is much more established. And as a result of that, you see US brands get substantial venture funding from US companies. You see US brands being able to take significant bets in terms of creating new products that may or may not be able to work or be sustainable for years and years and years. And that's largely a product of large CPG companies looking to acquire rather than build their own brands at this point. In the Canadian market, even if you look at the TSX, consumer goods companies aren't nearly as prevalent as they are in the US. And as a result, as a Canadian company, when we think about innovation, there's a blessing and a curse. The one is that we can innovate largely undisrupted and without a ton of competition from the domestic brands. That's the blessing, is that we've got the freedom and the latitude to be able to do that. I think one thing that we do need to do, though, is make sure that we're doing it with developing not just amazing brands, but an amazing business, because there isn't as active as of a VC and capital markets appetite up here versus what's happening down in the US, where a ton of venture-backed food brands can develop and launch products without really much worry of sustainability and on their P&L. So I think that's one of the biggest differences. In terms of distribution and how we think about that in Canada versus the US is it really depends on the brand and and the stage that the market and the consumer is at. I think Brainbow is a really good example of a company, or sorry, a brand that's going to take different approaches in the Canadian and the US market. In Canada, the market for adaptogens isn't quite as developed as it is in the US, especially the US coastal markets. So what that means in Canada is that we need to play a bit of a brand building ground game to find advocates for the brand and the category itself, before we can kind of seek larger, more widespread national attention. Versus in the US, adaptogens are an established product category where we actually fit onto a shelf and we fit squarely into a consumer. And so we can start to make bigger bets in terms of how we'll distribute there. So I think the strategy varies based on the brand and the location. And then also the channel mix is a huge part of that as well. I think for all of our brands, e-commerce is a huge part of how we bring ourselves to market and how consumers can find us. And it magnifies our efforts to be on shelf. And that's always going to be a part of our mix as well.
Definitely. I want to swing back to Dear Green and the sourdough platform. So there's a really great Netflix documentary by Michael Pollan called Cooked. And basically it takes the four main ways to cook food and it goes into this sort of global magnifying lens of where all of these cooking methods originated. And there's one episode on essentially I think they term it air, but it talks all about fermentation and it goes into bread. And how many people nowadays call themselves gluten-free or they're gluten intolerant or sensitive. And it goes back into the 60s or 70s. And I won't name the brand, but one of the largest well-known bread companies and how the proliferation and scaling up of that product that I think, I don't know if this is the case now, but there was something like 32 different ingredients that went into this plain white bread, which just seems asinine. But on the flip side, they go to, I think it was in Turkey, and they were showing at the root of bread, it really is fermentation and that sourdough, and talks about the simplicity of it being water, flour, and yeast, essentially, like just three ingredients and then the added element of air creating those chemical reactions. And ever since then, I was never somebody that's gluten intolerant or sensitive. But I've started eating sourdough and I've noticed that there's just, you don't have any bloating after. It's very, like, it's just, it's a cleaner way to eat bread. And as such, you know, I've followed along with your guys' sourdough platform and excited for the products that you're going to bring to market. What have you got? How do you just view sourdough relative to other conventional breads that you see on the market where, you know, whether you go to a grocery store or you're buying it at a convenience store or a bakery, the proliferation of ingredients that go into it, and maybe that's to make it shelf stable versus something like at the root of what sourdough is. Yeah, I think a lot of people's problems would be solved if they ate sourdough as opposed to the, you know, crappy quality stuff that they maybe have traditionally grown up on.
Yeah. And I think this is, I mean, this fits into a broader ethos of what's happening in food right now I grew up on the food of the 80s and 90s, which was designed around convenience, which means you can put it in the oven at 350 for half an hour, or you can boil it, or you can microwave it, and then you have dinner. And I think just broadly over the past 20 years, there's been a reshuffling of what food is in many consumers' minds, where it's food isn't nutrition that's convenient. Food is nutrition that's good for you. And I think sourdough is a fantastic example of that. I think anything in the many things in the natural or the better for you category of food is a movement back towards food being not convenient, but it being food that's designed to nourish. And I think if I look at sourdough versus I don't even want to say conventional bread, because conventional bread is not even conventional. It's chemical bread. It's the difference between having a glass of water and having a Coke, in terms of the health. I think it'll certainly fill you up for a half hour, but it's not going to provide you the nourishment of what happens when you give bread, or sorry, when you give flour, water, salt, yeast, time to become food. And that's really at its core why. Yeah, it's once you start eating sourdough bread and you feel nourished and you feel full and you feel like you've had a real piece of food rather than something that came out of a factory, it's incredibly hard to go back, because it's not even the same thing at that point.
Yeah, exactly. It's an interesting topic, and you know, I'm optimistic and excited to try the products that New SKU brings. So switching gears a little bit, I'm curious what thoughts you might have on the debate that's taking center stage in the food world around plant-based proteins versus animal-based proteins. And not necessarily from a political perspective, or, you know, this topic often gets quite polarized, but, you know, from how New SKU views it, what do you make of the debate? Because obviously there's people staunchly on both sides, and something that I've tried to do with Food for Thought is, you know, I've grown up and eaten a lot of animal-based proteins, and I've tried to make more conscious decisions since starting Food for Thought and pushing my boundaries of incorporating plant-based proteins. And a lot of them are actually quite great. You know, I've tried some products where I think there's a lot of hype around them, and turns out I don't think the taste is there nor the nutritional benefit. But I, you know, the inclusion of plant-based proteins is not going away. It's only going to grow. And I think the more that people that understand food help educate those that are, you know, working in banking or transportation or things where they don't have time to understand some of these concepts, how do you view that? And what are, when somebody asks you about it, what do you tell them?
Yeah. I mean, I think about plant-based versus animal-based in a similar vein is actually the sourdough, where it's a collision of so many different things. On the plant-based versus animal-based, it's for me at least, it's a collision of health and wellness becoming a bigger consideration in food. It's a collision of just economics and having an alternative that isn't going to break the bank when you're trying to feed a family of four. And I think about the environment where the choice of animal versus plant-based protein is somewhat clear there. And so I think I'm obviously, to a lot of people, but I am a consumer of animal protein. I enjoy nothing more, but I think there's now a place in people's diets where plant-based protein can realistically become a part of the cultural zeitgeist. And I think it takes a collision of so many different things, where you have a health benefit. You're not eating nearly as many saturated fats. You have an economic benefit where it might cost $5, $10, $1 less at checkout. And you've got an environmental benefit where I think one of the biggest things that became popular knowledge in the past decade is just how costly a burger is on the environment itself, which I think are conversations that people are having more actively, whether or not it's even about food. And I think just all of those things together is creating space in the market for new demand to emerge in a category that just wasn't a real category 2-3 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. It's very insightful. I want to be respectful of your time. I have three final questions, Alex. Firstly,
yeah, absolutely.
Being, what is a product category in grocery that you think is most ripe for disruption? Whether that's something you're currently disrupting or something that when you walk down the aisles, you just say, man, something's got to change in this aisle. It's pretty stale.
Cereal. it's a category that's largely unchanged from when I was a kid. When we think about food as being nourishing versus food as being convenient, I think cereal kind of sits at the heart there. And if we think about just being able to provide a better food at the beginning of people's days in a way that we can make them feel, that can make them feel nostalgic, that can make them feel nourished, and can make them feel like they're eating real food and not something that that pulled off a factory line, got packaged into a box 6 months ago and appeared on a shelf in front of them. I think there's huge opportunity for not just us, but a lot of brands that want to play in that space.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I've been trying to get Magic Spoon and Three Wishes north of the border, which has been difficult. And I'm trying to pull some strings to get some, because I really want to try the product. I don't eat cereal, but I grew up on it and I quite enjoy it. But it's just anything that's largely available on the market now, the nutritional benefits of it are very minimal at best. And I don't know if you know of any Canadian brands that are disrupting the space, and you know, maybe you guys are looking to take your bite out of it. But Magic Spoon and Three Wishes both look like they have fantastic products down in the US, and I'm trying to get some north of the border to try.
Absolutely. And they're, I think what's fantastic about them is that they're part of a bigger conversation. It's not just about cereal. It's about it's about better cereal. It's about cereal that's going to power up your day, and it's about cereal that's going to like Magic Spoon is keto. It's cereal that's better for you. Like, and it's, I think it's amazing branding. It's good products. But I think if we think about food and culture and how those things collide, there's more going on than just kind of that product in a bowl with I guess milk or alternative milk.
Definitely. And one side of that equation has, you know, been disrupted on a large scale, that being the milk side. I've tried a lot of different plant-based milks and they're fantastic. I like regular dairy milk, and I've tried hemp milk, pea milk, almond milk, cashew milk. I honestly haven't tried one that I didn't like. So we're just kind of waiting on the grain side of the equation, I guess, to change here in Canada. So excited to see what comes of it.
I think there's space for more things like that in more people's kitchens, which wasn't the case 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I remember, this is kind of getting off topic, but I remember back in high school, I was, you know, playing a lot of football and working out a lot, and I would eat cereal in the morning and two pieces of toast, and they weren't sourdough. It was, you know, kind of crappy bread you'd find from a grocery store and whatever cereal. And I always would get hungry and I could never figure out why. Now, keep in mind at the time, I didn't know anything about food. I was just, you know, high school athlete. But it makes so much sense now why I would get hungry an hour after eating something that just had, you know, these carbohydrate laden, zero protein, lots of fillers, binders. It makes complete sense now. Whereas now I can eat, you know, half a cup of full fat yogurt and be full for the morning and, you know, add some hemp hearts or whatever. So it's just funny how you look back to your comment earlier about the food of the 80s and 90s. Very much the same for me.
Oh man. I remember eating breakfast just before I walked out the door for school, and I would be dying by 10 o'clock, and thank God school lunches were, I still remember it. It's at 11:20. I was starving every day by 11:20 in the morning.
Yeah. And the funny part is oftentimes then you'd have a sandwich, just two of the same pieces of bread that you just had in the morning, but with, you know, a thin sliced turkey. So, I mean, it's just funny when you look at the nutritional benefit, and, you know, we're lucky to grow up in a society that we do and have food security, but, looking back on it, there's lots of bells certainly that ring. So,
absolutely.
Second last question. What is one of the most common misconceptions about entrepreneurship or building a brand that you've seen with New Skew?
I think it's a good question. I think as an entrepreneur, I think you're constantly in a position of needing to change how you think. Because I think the bar for what success looks like is always changing. And I think that's probably the most common misconception is that as an entrepreneur, there is success, or there is a finish line, or there is there's completion. And what I mean by that is when we started New SKU, success would look like making a product that we really like to taste. And then what the next thing is can we make 100,000 of that product? And then the next thing is, well, can we sell 100,000 of that product? And then the next thing is, and it goes on and on and on from there. And I think, when you think about success as an entrepreneur, it's, are you putting things into the world? Do people like the things that you're putting into the world? There's all these different things. And from the outside, I think, someone can look at it and say, oh, that's what being a successful entrepreneur is. But I think I wouldn't have known this before this adventure, but it is truly one of those things where, I always feel like we're at the point of just getting started, no matter, we can probably be triple the size that we are, a year from now, and it'll still feel that way. And I think that that's part of the excitement and the journey and the pain and everything is that there's really no beginning, middle, and end. It's a series of beginnings.
Exactly. That makes total sense. So my final question, you're somebody who lives and breathes food all day, every day. Sometimes the business of food gets in the way of enjoyment. So what is your favorite way to reconnect with food on a personal level?
I think for me, there's very few opportunities in the day to be truly creative when it comes to food, and going back to the desire to innovate like a chef, like the way that I reconnect is at the beginning of the day, or sorry, at the end of the day, sometimes at the beginning of the day, depending on how early I wake up, I cook, and there is opportunity to kind of, generally just make things that I've never made before, have things that I've never had before, or see if something works and experiment and see how it goes. And I think oftentimes I'm successful in making a tasty dinner, and other times we need to go for a walk to the nearest place to get takeout. But for me, cooking and more importantly, exploration through cooking is really how I unwind about it, where it's not about making something to sell. It's not about making something that looks good or looks pretty or is presented on a plate well. What it's about at the core is just making something that's tasty and nourishing.
Absolutely. Well, Alex, I appreciate you taking the time. Stay safe in Toronto and take care.
Thanks for the time, Mike.